It's the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 81, we discuss which US broadcaster is losing money on the World Cup. Kartik finally watches a little bit of Fox's coverage of the World Cup. What the future of Serie A is on US TV, plus a lot of letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer. A little bit hoarse today. It's just been a week of screaming at TV sets and cheering on England, and it's just been, I mean, it's been a whole month of World Cup soccer too, so it's finally catching up on me. And I'm joined today by my co-host Kartik Krishnaya. Kartik, how are you feeling? Are you feeling any better?
Yeah, there's been a World Cup effect that was delayed, where I'm just feeling worn down at this point, Chris, and then added complications of the Beckham Miami Stadium situation, some things related to AC Milan that I've been tracking, and Cristiano Ronaldo. It never ends.
Yeah, lots of stuff going on, and that's the thing, though, too. I mean, listeners will know this, and of course we know this, is during the World Cup, there's always other things happening too. So whether it's transfer signings, friendly tours being announced, other soccer business going on, and of course the World Cup, and much, much more. And you got Major League Soccer in Miami and the farce that it is there. Everything that's going on is just it's just insane. So Kartik, there was an article published this morning on Friday. We're recording this in The Guardian about Fox's coverage of the World Cup. I will say that during the entire World Cup, I don't think I wrote one story about Fox's coverage, because in some ways it was so bad that it kind of did the talking for itself. And I kind of just steered away from it because I was like, you know, we've been talking about it on the podcast every week. There's not necessarily a need to kind of go in and just keep on hammering away. There was so much that was bad with this coverage, but you got a chance to watch it a little bit at least, and to hear some of the analysis and commentary, probably for the first time during the whole tournament.
Yeah, so during the England-Belgium game, or sorry, not England-Belgium, England-Sweden game, I watched Fox, and I thought that Derek Ray and Ali Wagner were pretty good. I mean, some of your critiques of Ali Wagner I would agree with. I think that there's a lot of and this is an American tendency, I think, an American tendency to overanalyze certain things when you're a co-commentator. And she certainly did that, but she was also very good and very on point about some of the other things going on in that match.
I will say, though, I will just chime in just for a second, Kartik, and just say that she's gotten better. And throughout the World Cup, she got better and better. And then towards the end, when they made the announcement, Fox made the announcement that for the semifinals and the final, all of the games would be commentated by John Strong and Stuart Holden. I'm like, oh, come on. That's not fair, because Derek Ray and Ali Wagner had commentated each of the England games throughout the entire tournament. And to me, they deserve to get that. Ali Wagner, definitely not the best, but she's new to the industry, and she's getting better in terms of her commentating. And I just thought that was kind of Fox pulling the rug out at the last minute.
I thought it was a poor choice. Her co-commentary is pretty good on NWSL game matches on Lifetime. I've tended to watch those, and she certainly, I think in terms of that league, she's certainly probably the most knowledgeable person out there. I mean, when they've thrown Julie Foudy onto those broadcasts, she hasn't been as knowledgeable. Obviously, I think global football, world football, men's and women's, Foudy might be more knowledgeable than Ali Wagner, but she has not been when she's been around NWSL and the NWSL broadcast. That having been said, Ian Wright, and I'm going to talk about Ian Wright also on ITV Wednesday in a little bit. Ian Wright was awful, just terrible. I think Kelly Smith added a little, but not a whole lot of analysis. Lawless was good on that game. I saw Lawless later in the week, and he wasn't so good, although I don't think Lawless had, and again, I've watched very little Fox. Lawless has not come across as the clownish figure people are making him out to be, at least from my perspective. He's come across more as just someone without much depth in his analysis and without much understanding of tactics. He's more into the player psychology side of things. And and talking about those sorts of factors. And there's a place for that on a broadcast. But I don't think he's particularly insightful. And I just think Rob Stone is terrible. I mean, he's just he was a guy that essentially did the sort of things that Rachel Bonetta is doing quite well. I watched some of her work on Twitter, Fox work on Twitter. He essentially, that was his role when he was at ESPN for World Cups. Now, he did do studio in 2002, if I remember correctly, and I wasn't that annoyed by him then. But again, we talked about this before, and we actually had a commenter or two on Twitter agree with my analysis last week that Brian McBride has gone from being a dud on Fox to being very good on ESPN FC, on the ESPN FC program. Yep. Which again indicates to me it's a lot, you know, we can pick on personalities, but I think a lot of it is an institutional Fox thing and how they prepare their broadcasters and how they present their broadcasts.
Yeah, and we're not going to go kind of in depth today on Fox. We're not going to go into a lot more detail, but I did want to mention it because it's the first time that you've had a chance to actually kind of watch it, which goes to show how bad Fox's coverage has been, where there's been so many of us. You mean, I don't even speak Spanish, and I've watched most of the World Cup on Telemundo, and others have sought other means of watching this World Cup, that the coverage has been so bad that we've gone elsewhere.
I have to say this, though. If ESPN FC did not have a nightly show, which for the last couple of weeks has been airing regularly at 5 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2, and then obviously I have ESPN Plus, so I can always watch it there, I probably would have. I hesitate to say this, but I probably would have watched more Fox because I think I was still getting enough English language analysis from ESPN FC's nightly show. In addition to the bits here and there, I would see a BN and BN's coverage in the Middle East and North Africa, and then ITV or BBC. So
yeah, I think
had ESPN not continued the nightly program during the World Cup, and you and I talked about this 8 months ago, Chris.
Yeah.
I probably would have switched to Fox sooner, but ESPN made it possible not to.
Yeah, well, I think, Kartik, you would have probably done the same thing that I would have done, and many of the listeners would have done, which was given Fox a chance, and after about 3 or 4 days of their really, really basic analysis, you would have said, you know what, you're better off either not watching it at all, or watching another broadcaster, or just tuning in for the games themselves. And I found that, too, even the England... England-Croatia game, I was like, you know what? I don't even have to tune in before the game to get any pre-match analysis because the analysis is so dumbed down and so vanilla that I can just tune in at, you mean, once the game's getting ready to kick off, and there you go. And it actually freed up so much more time to go into games and even at halftime or post-match to freeze up times to do other stuff because the analysis was just it wasn't even worth watching. So for me, I would imagine the same thing probably would have happened to you. I mean, you listened to Fox and with it Lalas. And Lalas in bites is good. But for this World Cup, there's so many just hot takes. And really, he was on the television too much every single day.
Speaks to the weakness of their lineup, right?
Right.
So in fairness to Lalas again, I think he's been overexposed and he's had to work too much. And that's something that never happened at ESPN with any of their pundits. I mean, you could argue, there were times Taylor Twellman would pop up if he wasn't broadcasting a match. He'd just pop up in the studio in in Paris during the Euros, right? To give some quick studio analysis, but it would normally be a short segment. Okay, hey, Taylor's got the day off. He and Ian Dark don't have a game today. What's your thoughts on this match we just saw? What's your thoughts on Wales and Slovakia? And he would give that, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't any studio program that Fox has. And even when I've seen them on in the background, Lalas has been on. I haven't watched World Cup tonight. I haven't watched 1 second of that. So maybe that's the exception. But in terms of bumper coverage around games, he's on all the time. And I think that that's very difficult for any commentator, athlete, performer to just be on every day for 30 days in a row,
right?
In 3 hour blocks that are separate, or, you know, an hour or 2 hour blocks that are separate.
It's also too much for the viewer too.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you love Lalas, you might be like, okay, after about a week of him, okay, it's ready for somebody else to take that seat in the studio. But overall, Yeah, it was. I mean, to me, actually, Fox got things backwards. I mean, they really kind of emphasized the studio. They spent over $1 million on the studio set. They brought in all his talent, Lothar Matthäus, who never appeared. Gus Hiddink, Hernan Crespo. I mean, you go through the list of studio picks or talent that they had going into the World Cup, and it was horrible. I mean, Ian Wright was horrible. Kelly Smith was decent at times, but I mean, just basic pronunciations of names. I mean, continuously throughout the entire World Cup, to me, really kind of shows that she's not really watching much out of side of the English game, or maybe women's soccer, but she's not really watching La Liga, Serie A, or Champions League.
Yeah, I mean, and that's I hate to fall into this, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this. At least I'm going to bring it up. There are some bad stereotypes. I tend to be defensive of British commentators, but there are some bad stereotypes that I've seen kind of reemerge this week. And Kelly Smith not knowing much about players outside the Premier League is another one, right? Right. But just in general, and I think that was kind of a theme this week. In the coverage of the World Cup in Britain, we can, and there are exceptions. We can get to that in a few minutes when we get to England, Croatia. But that was something a concern about Kelly Smith. And then I also think there was just, again, when I watched Fox, Chris, and I bring this up all the time. I brought this up for years. The production, the loud graphics, the loud American announcer saying things. Even the promotion for the next game was loud and didn't make any sense. It wasn't done. And again, maybe it's personal preferences. Maybe we've just become so used to the way ESPN and NBC present intros and outros of segments, intros and outros of studio shows and promotions for future telecasts that we're not tolerant of the way Fox does it. But to me, that's worse than the commentary teams and worse than the studio talent.
Yeah,
it's just the way they present things. It's terrible.
Yeah, there's. I was thinking this morning, pretty hard actually, trying to think of okay, what positives can we think about Fox's coverage from this World Cup, going into the next World Cup, or going into the Women's World Cup? And the only one I could think of that was, I would say that from beginning to end was good. It was really kind of was interesting to listen to and was good. Was Stuart Holden. And I thought he did a fantastic job commentating throughout this entire tournament. In terms of where they went wrong, it's almost everything else. The one thing I think that they were missing really was somebody, an English language person or somebody that could speak English very well that had more of a Latino aspect. So, for example, somebody like Hercules Gomez or somebody like Sebastian Salazar, both of these guys with ESPN, but they would have been perfect in this studio set to actually... You mean talk about from the Latin angle? Yes, he had Moises Munoz from the Mexican angle, but he wasn't that comfortable in front of the camera after a few days. You could tell that he's not used to being in kind of a studio set where they're debating topics. And one example of this, I mean, there were so many examples, but just one example, Kelly Smith, when she's talking about Mexico, and she said Chicharito. I mean, just basic pronunciation.
I've heard English people call him that before, by the way.
And it's not meant to be picking on her, but just in general, there were so many across the board.
Sometimes with British commentators, which is why,
right.
Going back to someone you mentioned earlier, Derek Ray, who's Scottish, we love so much because he spends so much time and is impeccably prepared for these broadcasts.
Yeah,
and the pronunciation,
and that's the thing. Is I think he needed somebody that was kind of a bilingual that was on the set, that was intelligent, that knows these things like his or her back of the hand, and that was one thing I think they missed out on. But it was basically from start to finish pretty bad. I mean, the one thing about the England match, Kartik, about against Croatia. This one I did watch on Fox, but the commentary, I was so sick and tired of John Strong in this game. Talking about the same, I mean, one, being so talkative, two, bringing up so many stats, and then three, going on and on about it's coming home and the 1966 squad and kind of giving all the backstories. I'm like, just shut up. I mean, just let the game breathe. Just call the game. Just concentrate on the game. Commentate the game. stop talking about all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And to me, it reminded me so much of Arlo White. I was like, oh, I was just driving nuts.
Yeah, and there were, right, the Arlo White, like, backstories, of course. And then I think also there was a situation where he was trying to push the England narrative in a way that Fox hadn't earlier in the competition, again, owing itself to Mexico and Brazil being out of the tournament. So that to me was very obvious. And then I also was annoyed by John Strong's call of the Belgium-France game, where I thought he was too talkative. He opened with an American sports analogy. I got sick of him by minute 40 and turned to the international feed, which was actually Ian Dark calling that. Now, I have to say, though, when we talk about John Strong, there are critiques. I still think he's pretty good. I think Stuart Holden, what I've listened to him now, I think he's getting to that level, to that elite level.
Yeah.
And I think it may be reps. It may be that's always been there and he hasn't necessarily been comfortable. We've said positive things about him in the past and his analysis, but I think his timing was particularly good in the 40 minutes I watched of their coverage of Belgium, France, and then the same thing, England, Croatia. I think his timing and placement of points were very good. Now, again, you had Strong throwing a lot of stats out there that he had to react to, but I thought he did pretty well with that.
Yeah. Sometimes the questions from John Strong were just really basic questions. I mean, just trying to lead Stuart along, but so some of the questions could have been a little bit more intelligent from John to kind of ask something of Stuart that was a little bit more in depth or a little bit more analytical. But one thing, I mean, what just one example of Stuart Holden, and this was the Belgium Brazil game, and in the first minute of the game, Stuart Holden pointed out that Belgium was playing a 4-3-3 for the first time in the tournament, and that's what a really good co-commentator should be doing, is looking at the pitch, knowing the back, knowing what's happened beforehand in terms of formations and players and positioning and matchups and all those things. And for us, the TV viewer, not being able to see the entire pitch all at once, we're just seeing whatever the TV camera is showing us, kind of zooming in. For him to tell us that's informative. That's something that adds to the experience of watching this game. And Derek Ray partnered with Stuart Holden would have been kind of the dream team, I think, in many ways, in terms of kind of the best commentator and the best co-commentator. That didn't happen.
Meanwhile, ESPN FC has had a tournament full of Macca and Stuart Robson. They don't have Macca for this final week, but they've had Macca for the previous 3 weeks. And I have to say, I've been critical of him as a co-commentator in the past. As a studio analyst, he's fantastic. And Macca doesn't fit that English stereotype. He knows what's going on in La Liga and in Serie A and in the Bundesliga. They a little less so in France. But the other three, those three leagues I mentioned, he had a real grasp of the players from those leagues and how their club season had gone and how they could contribute to their sides. I was hugely impressed with him during this World Cup when I wasn't in the last Euros or the previous World Cups with ESPN. And also have to mention, since Cristiano Ronaldo began, I don't know if it was coincidence or it's classic Ronaldo, he had to obscure the World Cup for a day or two, that it was really good to have Macca on the ESPN FC studio team because he has an understanding of the politics of Real Madrid and Florentino Perez, the president there, that obviously Sid Lowe brings that to their show as well. But someone in studio actually sitting in Bristol that was able to kind of drive the conversation with Burley and Robson and Moreno and Dan Thomas obviously Dan Thomas intimate working knowledge of Real Madrid also. But I thought that was really good. So I wanted to single out Macca, or actually, point out Macca has been very good. And Craig Burley has been fantastic this entire tournament. He's been on point. I know some people are graded by him, but I've heard more praise of Burley in the last month than I had previously. I think, again, because people are watching Fox and then they're watching ESPN FC and they're preferring the ESPN FC coverage. And then Stuart Robson has been just fantastic in studio. I'm a little surprised, Chris, that nobody in the UK has Stuart Robson on their World Cup coverage. I'm not quite sure what the reasoning for that is, but we've enjoyed having him here in the States in Bristol during the World Cup.
Yeah, that's the thing that ESPN does so well, and also NBC, and to a lesser extent beIN Sports, is that they can tap into their network. So they can tap into experts from around the world, whether they're in the studio with them, or they're in Europe, or you know, Steve Bauer, the BBC studios, or if it's beIN Sports tapping into some of the experts in Doha, the kind of, you know, Andy Gray or whoever it may be.
Graham Souness, I want to say, it was fantastic when I saw him the other day. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute, but he was on beIN.
Yeah, Souness is one definitely that, again, love him or hate him, but he has an opinion and he backs it up and tells it the way it is. And I haven't had a chance to see him that much of late, but every time it seems to he's on, he's always I mean, the Twitter sphere kind of goes crazy, especially in the UK.
Yeah, I think that he was very, very critical of England, but his point was, you have, you know, you can look at the rest of the pitch, right? And you can say England this, England that. They have this advantage or that advantage against Croatia. His point was, and of course, think about the kind of player Souness was, if you remember his playing career.
Yeah.
His point was, Croatia had Rakitic, they had Modric. They have the two of the best ball-playing midfielders in the world. If you're not going to have a tactic to counter the strength of those two guys, they will pass you to death. And even if you dominate the first half of the game, they will eventually overtake you. And his point was, that's happened in every Croatia match in this tournament, where Croatia has started slowly, they've fallen behind, or they haven't looked as good as they could in the first half, and eventually they're probing and passing with those two guys on the ball beats you. And from his perspective, Southgate didn't anticipate this, didn't tactically understand it, and never reacted to it. Now, in fairness to Southgate, I would say that he didn't have Oxlade-Chamberlain, he didn't have Jack Wilshere, he didn't have Danny Drinkwater, he didn't have one of those English midfielders, and Ox being hurt, I think, is a big factor why England is out of this World Cup. But not having those guys limited his options to kind of slow Croatia's methodical, eventual death by a thousand cuts. That's how we describe how Croatia's been playing this World Cup, and that's why I think, you know, you can't overreact and say England dominated the first half. But on ITV, if you watch that, I mean, Lee Dixon, we love normally on NBC's Premier League coverage, but Lee Dixon, Ian Wright, very basic analysis. Oh, well, we dominated the first half. We could have been up 3-0, 4-0. I appreciate, and obviously Croatia were much better from minute 45, 46 to minute 120, but we could have been up out of sight. But that's not the point. I think Souness's point is better taken, which is that's the way Croatia's played the entire tournament. And coming into the tournament, you know they have two of the best ball-playing midfielders, if not the two best in the world. So you have to be able to counter that. I thought Gary Neville made some good points about the Premier League not promoting English players and Welsh players and players from Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland, et cetera, and made some good points about coaching in the Premier League, but he was entirely too parochial. I wasn't terribly impressed with Ryan Giggs' analysis on ITV post-game. Keane was good. Roy Keane was good. And let me tell you, the Keane moment with Ian Wright, Ian Wright had said absolutely nothing of substance that entire 45-minute post-game show or whatever. I mean, he was just awful. But as Dan Thomas pointed out on Twitter, to me, I can't remember if it was a general tweet or it was a response to me, but that happens all the time on the ESPN FC studio, because Burley says something and someone reacts, you know, whether it's Shaka or Casey Keller or who. But I didn't think it was that big a deal. I thought Keane was pretty much on the money, and England accomplished a lot by getting to the semifinals, but there seemed to be, and this stuns me considering Croatia's history of beating England in competitive matches in the past, there seemed to be an absolute disrespect and disregard for the quality in Croatia's team. I mean, you're talking about a guy like Kovacic at Real Madrid, doesn't even start for Croatia. Mm-hmm. Brozovic, who to me is the best holding midfielder in Serie A this past season, he didn't start. There are a couple games he didn't start. Now, he did start this England game. There was the same, Chris, English narrative of they were different coming into this tournament, the English media. But once they got to a certain point in the tournament, the arrogance, the disregard for the opposition, the assumptions that you had the better players, the lack of thinking about tactical considerations, all of that stuff that we criticized the English press for in the past and TV commentators in the UK just came back in this last week and bothered me. And I was supporting England. I've been rooting for England this entire World Cup, but I was kind of not bothered when Croatia went through because I said, that's the better team, and they had gotten no respect.
Right.
And Luka Modric even pointed that out post-game.
Yeah, I completely agree in terms of Croatia being the better side. Myself having no complaints that Croatia goes through. I mean, it's weird for me too because I was born in Wales. My mother's side of the family is completely Welsh. I consider myself Welsh and American. I have a US passport too. But also my dad's from England and my entire dad's side of the family is from England. So oftentimes, I mean, there's always kind of this Wales-England kind of rivalry between the two countries. So oftentimes, if I had to pick between the two, I'd pick Wales. But in the case when Wales is not competing, then I pick England. And this was a game, really, the Croatia-England game. I didn't underestimate Croatia at all. I think going into the match, I said to some of my friends, I said, my heart wants England to win, but my head says that Croatia will persevere. I mean, Croatia, in many ways, is England's bogey team. And there's a reason that they're the bogey team is because they are so skillful, especially in midfield. And for England, I think that was the part of the pitch that they actually were let down on. Is a lot of it was in terms of not just even the defensive midfielders, but the creative midfielders just pushing the through balls. Right,
there
exactly.
Were not, which was Sumis's point. Sorry. So,
let me finish. But the person I thought that they should have used was Fabian Delph. And I thought Delph could have done something a little bit different and actually being the creator, the provider a little bit more for England pushing forward.
Yeah, they didn't have someone flanking Henderson, and Henderson, I know, has gotten a lot of criticism, but he had too much work to do. They had, as Graham Souness pointed out, midfielders that wanted to get on the end of balls and not midfielders who wanted to play with the ball. And again, to Souness's point, you can only counter a Rakitic or a Modric with similar style players that keep the ball away from Rakitic and Modric. It's not only about winning a ball from Luka Modric or Ivan Rakitic in a tackle, but it's then about having midfielders that retain possession in midfield and for those two guys to track back more consistently. Instead, Souness's analysis was this was, you know, default England. They were playing long balls had midfielders who wanted to get on the end of long balls. So to him, this new England – now, of course, keep in mind Souness is Scottish and all of that, right? He felt like this New England had been overblown based on what he had seen when they came up against a good team, a good midfield.
I right.
Also have to point out, you know, guys like Perisic. Perisic is one of the top, at least from a technical standpoint, maybe not from a pace standpoint, top wingers in the world. Rebic was, you know, the last time I'd seen him before the World Cup was in the German Cup final, and he was unplayable in that game. So. They just have a lot of good players, and I think the English media, in some respects, did the England side a disservice. They were always going to be an underdog against Croatia. They don't have the level of player, particularly in midfield and out in wide areas, that Croatia has. They don't have the skill level. It was pretty good the fight they put up against a team that, you know, was always, you know, particularly when you give them 30 extra minutes, going to pass you to death.
Yeah,
and that's what happened with Spain in the 2010 World Cup. By the way, it was the same thing when teams played Spain. You know, they were the glimmers of hope, and then they eventually overtake you. That's why I know, you know, we're not necessarily previewing the final, but that's why I think again it's pretty silly for people to just say, "Oh well, Croatia's played all this extra football, so France is going to wipe them out." But Croatia plays different football. They keep the ball, and they have again. Think about it. We always said if England could get Lampard and Gerrard playing well together, they could win a World Cup. It's been the same discussion with Croatia, Chris. I don't know how many times you and I have been in press boxes last year at the El Clasico when I turned to you and said, I don't understand why Croatia never wins anything when they have both these guys.
Right.
And at other games, which we've watched together, where there have been other Croatian players who've starred. I think the point was once they got Rakitic and Modric in a system where they were both getting enough touches and working well together – they're going to be really tough to beat. I don't care Brazil, France, who. They were going to be tough to beat. And we're seeing that in this World Cup.
And that's the thing. I mean, we'll just finish on this before we move on to TV streaming news. That's the part that we're missing with the Fox's coverage is somebody to be able to break that down analytically, I mean, Ian Wright is really an entertainer. He's kind of joking and laughing, and Kelly Smith is trying her hardest, and Clarence Seedorf was a good late addition, and he provides his analysis. But then, you mean, Lallis is there doing hot takes, but the four of them are not working together. They're not kind of, you mean, having that intelligent discussion. They're, each of them is a different type of personality, and that's the mess that we ended up with Fox. So Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, so Facebook has continued its sports rights shopping spree by reportedly obtaining English Premier League rights for several Southeast Asian countries and Spanish La Liga rights for India. According to sportstechie.com, Facebook is set to have outbid beIN Sports and Fox Sports Asia for all 380 fixtures over three Premier League seasons starting in 2019-2020. That's the new contract cycle. The amount paid was $265 million. The UK newspaper wrote that YouTube and Netflix were also interested in some of the EPL's international rights. As we've said before, keep watching this space. That's where a lot of things are going.
Yeah, and especially with that, if true, Netflix at least being interested in international rights. So probably Facebook's more likely. But what do you think, though, Kartik? I mean, you've been to India. I mean, in terms of watching games on Facebook, Premier League games, how would that be received?
I think there are more people in India on Facebook than in the – I mean, the U.S., the popularity of Facebook has actually dropped. I mean, I've seen some data on that and metrics on that from marketing people. I think it'll probably work out. But for La Liga, the big thing now is that they're not going to have Cristiano Ronaldo. So that's a pretty big blow in those sorts of markets, in markets like India, where the interest in La Liga was driven by Ronaldo and Messi. Now, I think this World Cup might end up being useful for them, because they're still going to have either a Griezmann win it or Modric or a Rakitic. So some major La Liga star is going to win the World Cup. But I think losing Ronaldo takes a bite out of them in those secondary markets.
Speaking of Cristiano Ronaldo, we've got an update on the Serie A TV rights battle in the United States. So some of the history around this is that for the 2017-18 season that ended, that was the last season on beIN Sports in the United States. And since then, there's been a lot of conjecture in terms of where it's going. According to my sources, it's a battle between ESPN and Turner Sports over who is going to acquire the rights in the United States to Serie A. Now, before Cristiano Ronaldo signed for Juve, it was really a battle between ESPN Plus and Bleacher Report Live, the streaming services for who would get Serie A. And from what I understand from IMG, Serie A rights, the FA Cup was added to the Serie A rights to combine them together, because the TV broadcasters weren't that interested in Serie A. Now, with Ronaldo signing for Juventus, everything changes. And this possibility, there could be it could be somebody coming in late, whether it's Fox or somebody else coming in for these bids now that Ronaldo is going to be part of the Serie A package. But one note of caution for Serie A fans, because there's going to be a lot of people applauding on Twitter and social media that beIN Sports no longer has the rights. But be careful what you wish for, because if the league does go with ESPN or Turner Sports, it could still be that most of those games will be on ESPN Plus or Bleacher Report Live. Both of them are paid subscription services. ESPN Plus is $5 a month. Bleacher Report Live, we're still yet to find out what the cost of that's going to be. So it's an interesting timing. I mean, the timing actually for Serie A is perfect. If they can get some new bidders to come into the process, or if it's too late, at least to be able to increase the value of those rights. But watch this space and see what happens. Meanwhile, in the UK, BT Sports has lost the Serie A TV rights to 11 Sports. And 11 Sports is in the US also. 11 Sports has the Belgian league and is owned by the owner of Leeds United.
Correct, who's a resident here in the Miami area. Just one quick point on your Serie A, what you just said about Serie A. Keep in mind what happened with the English Championship. People were applauding when the matches were on ESPN3. Once ESPN Plus launched, they put everything behind the ESPN Plus paywall, including the playoff final. So, which was always very accessible on BN, even if BN was sporadic in how they covered the season to that point. So, again, sometimes be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, though, too, Kartik, to see. I mean, say ESPN does get the rights to Serie A, is if they put the vast majority of the Serie A games on ESPN Plus, and then maybe just save the event, maybe the big games, and maybe have those on ESPN2. That's a possibility. Or they could say, with like the championship, and say, hey, everything's on ESPN Plus, and we want to drive people to subscribe to that service.
Yeah, certainly a lot to think about there. Moving on, according to the Wall Street Journal, both Fox Sports and Telemundo have lost money on the World Cup. Fox paid $200 million for the rights to the 2018 World Cup. As of July 7th, Fox's World Cup TV ad revenue was roughly $107 million. This is in comparison to $187 million that ESPN generated in TV ad revenue for the entire 2014 tournament. And so far, Fox is reporting they still haven't sold all the ad inventory for the World Cup final. Meanwhile, Telemundo paid $300 million for the Spanish language rights to this World Cup. And so far, Telemundo has generated only $127 million in ad revenue compared to the $336 million that Univision generated for the entire 2014 World Cup. So I think the networks maybe can say they bought a little prestige at a cost, particularly Telemundo, because they're a distant second to Univision in Spanish language households. But both are going to end up losing money, it looks like.
Okay, Kartik, a question for you here on the spot. Is that obviously, I mean, a big factor in this, obviously, is the U.S. men's national team not making it qualifying for the World Cup. Those numbers would have been completely different if the U.S. had made it. But were there any managers or any coaches from this tournament that you saw that you might say that person might be a good fit for the men's national team job?
For the U.S.?
Yeah.
I don't know why anyone would take the job. I know I've been hearing about Roberto Martinez, but I don't know why he would want to take the U.S. job and subject himself to the rules and regulations and the bureaucracy of the U.S. Soccer Federation. I mean, look, Dalic has impressed me, the Croatian manager, who, by the way, was managing the United Arab Emirates. Let me back up here and tell the story. He was managing the United Arab Emirates. Croatia was one game away from being eliminated and qualifying with all the talent they have. As we've talked about, two of the best midfielders in the world, arguably one of the best wingers in the world, one of the best holding midfielders in the world, a guy in Kovacic who is one of the emerging talents in the world. And they were about to be eliminated. They'd finished behind Iceland. They needed to go to Ukraine and beat Ukraine in Kiev. They hire Dalic, who had been managing the United Arab Emirates and around the Middle East for the last 6 or 7 years, has never managed at a big European club, never had a cap with the Croatian men's national team. You know, was kind of just a bit part player in his time. He wins that game in Kiev. They then smash Greece in the playoff. That was just to get into the playoff to win that game. Mm-hmm. And they haven't looked back. And I noticed in the very first game against Nigeria, even though they were leading 1-0, things were not going well. He made a tactical change to bring Brozovic on, Kramaric off, and allowed Modric and Rakitic, particularly Modric, to have more kind of space to operate. And Croatia hasn't looked back since. And then he had to make a kind of an opposite change against Denmark to keep Croatia alive in that game. And it worked. And he's tinkered a lot, Rebic, Kovacic, if Perisic plays wide or whether, he's given kind of running room to make diagonal runs. He's really impressed me as far as managers are concerned. I guess Sampoli, I've heard, linked with the U.S. job. I don't know why he would want to manage the U.S. There's some managers who definitely impressed me. I mean, Carlos Quiroz has ties to the U.S. Soccer Federation in the past, has worked for the federation. I think Iran was pretty good in this tournament before they were eliminated. And there are people who tell me, oh, well, yeah, that would be a natural fit. But again, I don't know if he would do it at this point. So yep. I think there were options, definitely. But my expectation is that the U.S. either hires a current MLS manager or someone that they're really comfortable with that's maybe a former kind of Americanized, like an Osorio, that type of person.
Yeah, I think all everything's pointing to Osorio to be the next coach. I mean, the one person, I mean, you mentioned Roberto Martinez, which would have been a perfect fit in many ways, but with him signing a new contract with Belgium, that's unlikely.
And why would he leave the Belgian job to take the U.S. job? That's why I don't understand the law. I mean, again,
but Kartik,
like Grant Hall like to make the U.S. job into a bigger deal than it is. It's not a terribly relevant job at the international level. Let's be honest.
But going back to what you said earlier, which is like, why would anyone take it with all the bureaucracy, and why would Roberto Martinez take it? Money. I mean, the U.S. men's national team, we can see from these World Cup numbers in terms of, you mean, Fox and Telemundo, the pressure that they must be putting on USSF, saying, hey, we bought the rights to this World Cup. You better make sure that, you know, you bring a top-level manager in and get this team back playing well, because we're losing money. We're losing millions. I mean, and that's just one angle of it. There's a whole bunch of other angles. But I think it's money. Is that the USSF should be able to pay top-level salary to somebody to bring him in and
look,
just change
and
things.
And I know this hasn't been talked about a whole lot, and I guess maybe I'm maybe it's been on Twitter a little bit. Maybe people like Grant Wall have reported it. I know when things were getting really bad during the Klinsmann period, towards the end of Klinsmann's tenure, sponsors of U.S. soccer were beginning to put pressure on them, saying, hey, you know, you might not qualify for – turned out didn't qualify for the World Cup after the coaching change was made. But you may not qualify. The team isn't consistently performing well even in the Gold Cup anymore. Make this change or make some sort of change.
Yeah.
So the pressure can come from there. And from ESPN and Fox and from Telemundo and Univision and from sponsors. So that's a good point. Maybe Roberto Martinez is in play if that pressure comes. But I don't know why Martinez would there's kind of a renewal in faith in Martinez. As badly as things went for Everton, you get to the analysis pre-tournament and guys like Stuart Robson would say, oh, yeah, look at the squad Belgium has, but I have concerns about the manager. We know Roberto Martinez. There would be consistent analysis like that about Belgium. That's gone now. I think people are saying, okay, they didn't go well against France. He didn't have Meunier. Meunier gets suspended. They don't have another right back. But he did a good job. So I don't know that he wants to risk that at this point by taking the U.S. job.
Yeah, I think I mean the issue is more I think about the he's under contract. I think he's got like what a three or four year deal left with Belgium. So in terms of breaking that contract, how much would that cost the USSF to have to pay to the Belgian FA? I mean, one is money. The second of it is if that person was able to push the US up and you mean take him far in a tournament. I mean, you're a rock star. You're huge. I mean, the potential, the upside is much, much greater than the downside. And this U.S. team right now has a long way to go. I mean, it's nowhere near as good as good as other nations, but there's an opportunity at least to become the hero and to become, you mean, the greatest manager ever, you mean, in the United States type of thing. But he'll probably end up being an MLS coach. Who are we kidding? All right, Kartik, let's move.
Former MLS coach in Osorio, right? A guy that was MLS for a long period of time.
Let's move on. Just one last news item before we move into TV ratings.
Yeah, so in May, we reported that Fox Sports had acquired the Liga MX rights to Club Tijuana, the Zolos. Now we're starting to see that Fox Sports regional channels will be broadcasting the games beginning next week, July 21st. The first to announce the show that they'll show the games is Fox Sports Arizona. Hopefully, we'll hear more from other Fox Sports regional channels soon. Chris, I can give an update on this. I've talked to some sources around the Fox Sports Florida and Fox Sports Sun, the two regional networks in Florida. There is some interest in airing these games. I'm not guaranteeing they will be, but they might be on locally here in the state of Florida. So that's good news for you and me and our listeners in Florida if that happens.
Definitely. All right, TV ratings. So we don't have a ton of numbers to talk about this week. We will have all of them on worldsoccertalk.com. We're busy compiling those. But just a few numbers that jump out. 6.3 million for Russia-Croatia quarterfinal on Fox on Saturday. That one, part of the reason it was such a huge number is, one, it's on a weekend. Two, it went into extra time and penalty kicks. And three, it was an entertaining game too. So 6.3 million average for Fox there. The England-Croatia semi-final on Fox, which is on Wednesday during office hours, 2 p.m. Eastern, had 5.5 million on Fox. and we're still waiting to get the numbers from Telemundo in regards to what they got. One more thing is from this past weekend, we had the doubleheader, had the World Cup game, I think the Russia-Croatia game actually, and then right after that was the MLS game, and it was the Sounders against the Timbers, and that one had 1.16 million viewers, marking the third largest Major League Soccer regular season audience since 2008. So Major League Soccer is doing really well in terms of living off the World Cup viewership. So hopefully that will continue. All right, Kartik, let's move on to listener mailbag. The first one up is from Zach Berwin via Twitter. He says, the problems with Fox Sports' production and analysis are bad regardless of the sport. Superficial analysis, not enough focus on the game itself. It has to be the producers and production philosophy. The talent is better when they're not shackled by Fox. NFL is worse. And that goes back to what we talked about last week where we asked, what is it? What is it about Fox's coverage that makes it so bad? Is it the talent? Is it the production? Is it the philosophy? And some good feedback there from Zach in terms of some of the coverage, Fox's coverage of other sports. Ross Davenport through Twitter says, the only way to watch the World Cup in the US is with this method. 4K video feed muted, and then the BBC TV commentary synced through an iPad to the Bluetooth soundbar. So
I like that.
Yeah, that sounds like a good setup. Clay DeVoe on Twitter says, the Fox broadcasts, all of them, have been incredibly poor, boring, and simplistic. Martin O'Neill, Derek Ray, Stuart Holden, John Strong, Jorge Perez Navarro, Mariano Trujillo, and Grant Wall have been the bright spots. Miola has been the most improved. Actually, most improved, I would say that. Not perfect by any means, but most improved, definitely. Anthony Bello, through email, says, hi guys, great job covering the World Cup. But seeing it's about to end and we are about to go back to normal with the club season, I have a couple of questions. With Ronaldo going to Juventus, do you think the Serie A deal will get done in the States by the start of the season? In answer to that, yes, definitely. It's looking very likely it'll get done by the end of July. And I think the season starts about the middle of August. Also, how do you guys think this will affect La Liga TV ratings this season and TV rights negotiations next year? Kartik, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I think it's going to hurt La Liga rights. I don't think there's any question about that. And the ratings have been so good, you know, and maybe above BN's price point going forward. Maybe this gives BN a break to where they can retain the ratings. I still expect the package to be competitively bid on. It's still Barcelona and Real Madrid, which are brand names irrespective of players, right? And have developed that following in the United States. Perhaps there's a fallback factor here without Ronaldo in the league and without Neymar in the league, and that's another factor, although he could be back in the league. Maybe Kylian Mbappe comes out of this tournament as the next great global superstar. He ends up in La Liga by the time this new TV deal is negotiated. Who knows? But I think it can't help. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah, and it's important to note, too, that La Liga, this is the last season that's going to be on beIN Sports. So as of the end of the 2018-19 season, that's it. And then it's up for bidding, and maybe beIN Sports will retain it, or maybe somebody else will come in for this right. It'll be interesting to watch. Anthony says, finally, will Bleacher Report be on Apple TV or Amazon Fire TV? Good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I will check with Bleacher Report and see if I can get the answer to that. And then let's go ahead and move down to Nuke via Twitter. Says, we are not renewing our NYCFC season tickets because of the stupid nets the Yankees installed. Where is the stadium? And so the stadium, I know I saw a piece this week said that they're going back to a site or location near the first place they were thinking of having a stadium, and they're looking into that. Have you heard about the nets, Kartik?
Yeah, it's just a mess, this whole thing, and somehow that club continues to perform pretty well. I mean, obviously, the parent ship, the mothership City Football Group in Manchester City have sent them two really high level coaches in a row. But wow, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, even it's so difficult in this political climate now with getting funding and land, not just funding, forget funding. Even if you're going to privately fund something, land for a sports stadium, where the general feeling is in urban areas. And this is what we're going through in South Florida now with Miami. The general feeling is you want as much green space as possible. And I complain often that there isn't enough green space in Miami. As Miami has gone from this kind of sleepy Florida, typical Florida city to now a global international commercial center, you know, a major international financial center also, there's no park space in downtown. There's no park space in the city. New York has a lot of park space, but they don't want to give up that park space for a stadium. Which we've seen already that go through that process with the Cosmos also prior to New York City FC. So I'm not terribly optimistic. I think it's a little unfortunate for MLS. The timing is bad. I mean, they came in and emerged as a strong league and a popular emerged as a popular sport after, quite frankly, Major League Baseball in particular had pillaged municipalities and local governments throughout the country, getting stadiums built in urban centers and in city cores that have not had the economic benefit that their projections, their very skewed projections forecast.
Right.
So it's tough now to get a stadium. I don't know what's going to happen with New York City FC. I honestly don't. I think it's really unfortunate. I tend to be a person who cuts MLS some slack on this because I understand the political difficulties. And I know that there's people out there who've said, hey, there's one standard for Cincinnati and Orlando and Minnesota and wherever else, Nashville. And then there's another standard for New York and Miami. You also have to understand from a commercial standpoint for Major League Soccer, New York and Miami are global commercial centers or global media centers. You need to be in those markets. So the rules for Miami just logically shouldn't be like the rules for Nashville. No offense to Nashville. Mm-hmm. A lot to chew on here, but Nuke, I kind of appreciate the frustration and understand it.
Yeah, New York's definitely a challenge. With Miami, I still say, I mean, go back to Miami Lakes and play at Hard Rock Stadium, one of the best soccer stadiums in the country. And you've got a stadium already there that's not going to cost you a dime. And it's not being used from, March to September. But there's other political issues with that, which we won't
get into. Right, well, the tennis tournament will be going on down in March right there. So that's the issue.
Yeah, but I don't know. That's a small issue.
I don't know how long the Miami Open is going to be. That's a whole other issue. We'll get into that another time.
All right, last question is from Addition by Relegation through Twitter, and this one's for you, Kartik. It says, would it be possible for Kartik to give a quick update on the status of NASL? I haven't heard much about it since they canceled the season, and I'm curious what their plans are for the future.
Oh, boy. Okay, so there's been motions filed in the trial, the antitrust case, and a potential trial date about a potential trial date and discovery phase just in the last week since July 3rd. So in the last 10 days, that have not really been reported on widely. I'm actually putting together something for Sport Business on it that will probably run next week just because everybody's been caught up in the World Cup. It just haven't given those updates. Now, based on those pleadings and those filings, I think it's pretty safe to say 2019 will not happen and 2020 is in jeopardy in terms of those seasons. Now, Rocco Commisso this past week, after he his deal to buy AC Milan fell through, has said the New York Cosmos will be back and playing somewhere next season. I'm on the inside at Miami FC. I can tell you that organization remains committed to trying to find a place to play. My understanding is Jacksonville, who I'll see tomorrow, when they play Miami FC in the championship game of the NPSL conference, is in a similar mode, but the league itself will not have a 2019 season. I think it hasn't been formally canceled, but based on the filings of the court case, it would be impossible for them to have a 2019 season. So we're looking at 2020 at the earliest. I will say that there are conversations going on, Addition by Relegation, that may give us another professional league in this country outside of USL, involving some of the top teams in UPSL and NPSL and some startups potentially. Or you might just see teams go to USL. You know, yeah. both options are in play.
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is, from myself, a neutral kind of looking at this, is that you've had USSF, Major League Soccer, and USL effectively working together to shut NASL down and to push them down and get mired in court cases and even all this stupid nonsense, really, at the end of the day. And the end result is NASL is not playing, and then it looks like 2019 is very unlikely, and 2020 is in jeopardy. So yeah, it's awful.
And then you've got the two most prominent owners. I just have to throw this out there, and I'm cheesed at the beginning of the show. In Rocco Camiso and Ricardo Silva, both looking at investing in AC Milan. Ricardo Silva is an AC Milan fan, lifelong AC Milan fan. So that's another factor where, again, eventually, if you choke the life out of independent soccer or sort of soccer outside of USL and MLS, you will have investors that are putting their money in the US market. And in the case of Camiso, a guy who's an American, begin to spend money overseas that they would have spent in the domestic market. And I think that's a very damaging thing. It's great for Milan. It's a club that's been through a lot the last few years, a fall from grace, and great to have some new investment there. But it's not necessarily good for American soccer that you lose that level of investor, that level of owner. But you know, to be continued, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, and these are multimillionaires too, so it's no small change there. So you can always reach us via email if you have any questions, feedback, need advice, anything you want to get off your chest, through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can post your comments on the website, worldsoccertalk.com, and we would be glad to read those out on air. So, Kartik, where can they find you if they want to catch up on your latest rants and insights on Twitter?
Yeah, KKFLA737, and hopefully in the very near future have some written articles out there at sportbusiness.com, as I mentioned, and also at worldsoccertalk.com.
Yep, and you can reach me at World Soccer Talk. So thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. And Kartik, heading into what is the World Cup final weekend, what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.